everybody. I'm your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Really good. I got a massive amount of coffee ready to go. And you know me, I love my coffee.
Yes, you do. So it takes a lot to get you through an episode.
No. I don't want to make it sound like I burn the candle at both ends. So very often I need the caffeine. And hopefully our viewers and listeners, if you're not already subscribed, you will click the subscribe button that's down below. Over here. You know. Click the thumbs up if you enjoy the content. As I mentioned last time, I resurrected the link tree. So we also have the email address if you'd like to send us your comments, your ideas, and we'll be happy to hear from you and keep that information confidential if you'd like. And with that, I think I've said too much, and I'm going to have to edit out a lot because I'm having a problem today, folks. So hopefully Patty won't, and I'm sure she's going to regale us with some wonderful stories right now, of which...
Well, I am going to talk a little bit today about some demonic entities. So I'm working on a book called Demons in Penn's Woods. My middle boy, Mike, has been wanting me to finish this book forever and ever and ever. And it's one of those things, it's not a paying project yet. So you put it off for the paying projects. And, you know, so I have a little downtime. So I decided to start working on it again. And that's what put us into this subject, because I was getting into it and I thought, oh, there's some really cool stories I should share. So it's about demonic entities. And the truth is, you know, I've had more than my share of bumping into this stuff over the course of a lifetime. And if anybody wants to check that out, we have some old episodes where I talk about some of the personal stories. But I wanted to tell a couple that I know very well because they are stories I either researched or worked or know the people who worked. And the first one I wanted to talk about was a story that actually starts in 1966 in central Pennsylvania. And it's about a young man who came home from the military on leave. He met a young lady. It's an old story. And they had a whirlwind relationship, if you will. And before he went back, he was home for a couple months. And before he came back to work, she told him she was pregnant. So he told his father. And his father was very concerned because in small towns, everybody knows everybody's story. You know what I mean? And right. Her story wasn't a good story. Barring the gossip, she just came from a very difficult family with a really weird history. So my dad knew these folks, and I heard the story from them while they were telling my father over the years about it. Well, anyhow, this young man had said he wasn't going to marry the young lady. He would take care of the child and pay for everything, but he wasn't going to. But when he told the girl, she got really upset and started to bawl, and he felt guilty. So it was a spur of the moment thing. They literally went and got married at the Notre Republic, you know, kind of thing. And did it without anybody knowing. So now he's suddenly married to a young lady who has a toddler already from a previous relationship and is supposedly pregnant with his child. He gets a hardship leave from the military because of all of the stuff that's going on, and they give him some time to get his stuff straightened out. And it's during this period that all of this begins. So he rents a small apartment. They move into the apartment, and he starts to learn about their family. This was so whirlwind, he really didn't know the family at all. He had met them a couple times, but nobody really talked. So basically, here's the characters. So there is her father, who she calls Papa. And Papa is kind of mentally not there. He just sort of sits on the porch in his bib overalls and swings on the swing, goes in the house. He can, you know, go use the restroom, will get a plate of something to eat when the food is cooked. Rarely talks to anybody, just kind of hangs. And he's kind of a sidekick to the whole group. Mom is this very rail thin woman with long, stringy, gray hair. Everything about her is gray. her skin, her pallor, everything about her. She's just very, and she's very super religious in a creepy kind of way. Like everything that said, she quotes Bible verses for. And she always has all these little wise sayings for everything. And she kind of is off-putting for that reason. And then there is Reverend Mark, who is the is mom's brother, and he seems to be at the house all the time. He's just always there. And the young lady, her name is Neely. Neely, that's pregnant. She calls him her dad, which was weird because like the guy that was introduced as her dad is Papa, and how could her uncle be her dad? So, I mean,
I'm not gonna take a guess.
Yeah, well, he does go there. So, eventually, he comes to realize that there's a really weird relationship. He hears stories and rumors, and people talk about the family, and it comes out that there was an incestuous relationship, and that she was the result of that relationship. That her son is the result of that relationship as well, if you get my drift. So it's a really rough family. And this is the reason that his dad didn't want him to marry into this family, because there's a lot of really bad stories and stuff that is part of this process. So he's stuck kind of now. He's married. He's got responsibility for this toddler. He's got a baby coming. And now he's really wondering what the heck he got himself into. And one day they're invited to go out to Reverend Mark's house, which is out in the country, out in the middle of nowhere, up an old dirt lane. You go up this old lane and there's this farm, and he goes up there and it's like a family get together, but he's uncomfortable. It's just an awkward feeling in this place with all these people. And he decides to just make an excuse and go for a walk. So he goes for a walk, and there's this old, what would look like it was an abandoned shed through along a little path in the woods, except that the path is well worn. You can tell people are coming and going out of this little area all the time because the grass is worn away and there's gravel and what have you. And it looks like somebody walks up and down there quite frequently. It has a couple windows in it and the shed is locked. So, but there's something about it. On one hand, it gives him the heebie-jeebies like nobody's business. Absolutely. And on the other hand, he's curious, more curious than he could possibly explain. So he decides to see if he can get into the shed and see what's really in there. Because all he can see from the window is just some potting soil and some old flower pots and crap like that. But there's something that compels him that he needs to get in that shed. And he does find one of the windows unlocked. He shinnies on through the window and into the shed. And there's piles of boxes and wrapped up stuff in newspaper. And he's poking around a little bit. And he gets caught. You know, people came looking for him and he gets caught. So he's making excuses about, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done this. I was just really curious. I apologize. And Reverend Mark says to him, you best be careful, boy, because you might have just unleashed it. I had it locked in here, and I bet you let it out. Yep, that's what I bet you did. And this guy, this young guy's like totally confused. He's scared, and he doesn't know why. But they make him leave the shed, and they lock it all up tight and lock the windows down. And he's, you know, there's nothing in the shed to steal. So why are they so adamant about the shed with these old packs of something wrapped in newspaper? And that night he goes home and it starts. He lays laying down in bed. The young girl, Neely, she's sleeping beside him. The baby's in the other room. You can hear the baby, you know, breathing slow and soft. And that's when he hears the child cry. It's the sound of a newborn infant. And it's a scream, just as loud as could be, like it's in absolute fear. And he jumps up and he's like, what the heck is that? Neely wakes up and she's like, turn the TV off. He's like, I don't have the TV on. And she sits up and she's like, where's that coming from? The only other people that live in this building, it's actually an old house that had been turned into three apartments. So there were two other couples that lived in the apartments. One of them was an old gentleman who's lived by himself, and nobody had seen anybody around, like kids or anything like that. And the other was a young couple who had no children. So, and this sounds like it's in the room with them. And then just about that quick, the door opens and closes and opens and closes and opens and closes three times very quickly. And they have the lights on, and he feels like whatever it is coming into the room after them. So he jumps up and he runs out the door to grab the little baby, the toddler, out of the other room and get them all at least in the same space, because he has to be able to protect them all, and he wants them all together for that reason. And when he does, the door to the little boy's room slams shut in front of him, and he can't get the door to open. There's no lock on it, but the door won't open. It won't budge. So he's beating on this door with his shoulder, trying to pop it open like you see in an old TV movie, and can't get in there. And then he hears the baby inside, the little toddler, crying. And he's like, what the heck is going on? And Neely has followed him out into the hallway, and she's hitting on the door too, and they can't get it open. And she's like, we got to call my mom. She'll know what to do. And about that time, the curtains that were at the end of the hallway that led to the downstairs. So there was like a kitchen, a living room, up a little set of steps, a set of curtains, and two small bedrooms. So it's just this little tiny apartment. Those curtains start billowing out. Well, the telephone is downstairs. 1960s, they had wall phones. We didn't have cell phones. So he tells her, he's like, we got to go through those curtains. We got to go downstairs. We got to get to the phone. We're going to go out to the car after we make a phone call, and I'm done. Well, they call her mom, and her mom basically just says, I'll call my brother, which is Reverend Mark. And he piles them in the car, and they go across town to mom's house and refuses to go back that night. Well, Reverend Mark shows up, and he's like, yep, I figured it. You did it, didn't you? And he's like, I don't know what you people are talking about. You're all freaking insane. I just want whatever's going on to stop. I want a normal life. I don't know what you people are into, but stop it. So the Reverend goes over, and he's there for a while, and he's talking and he's yelling, and his sister had come along, and she's screaming Bible verses at the walls. And, you know, this poor young guy's like, don't wake up the neighbors. Like, the last thing I want to have to explain to my landlord is that there's crazy people shouting Bible verses at 3 a.m. because there's demons in my house. And that's basically what he was being told. So this went on for about an hour, hour and a half, and it all kind of calmed down. And Reverend Mark told him it was okay to go to bed. So they reluctantly laid down again, and everybody left. It was okay for a couple days, and then it starts again. He would set a cup of coffee down on the table, and it would shoot across the table and fly off and hit the wall. So it wasn't even like, you know, sometimes something that's got sweat on it or whatever, it's wet, will slide on the formica or something. It wasn't like that. It was like something slammed it and smashed it across the room into the wall. And the silverware drawer opened on its own. Silverware came flying out of the drawer and flew at him, which you can imagine could be quite painful. You have forks, knives, and spoons flying at you. The little toddler was sitting on the floor playing, and he got picked up and thrown against the wall twice right in front of them. And fortunately, nothing serious, but there were bruises. And the interesting part of that is not only was he bruised from hitting the wall, but there was a bruise and a scratch on the back of his neck where his collar was, as though whatever had grabbed him had nails and had dug in as it was, you know, going. So, of course, he doesn't know what to do. He's not a religious person. And truth be told, he'd only been in church maybe two or three times his entire life, and this was well beyond his pay grade. So he calls his mother-in-law, and they get Reverend Mark and her, and they come back over, and they do their shtick again, and it lasts for a few days. And then it keeps on going. There's yelling and screaming in the middle of the night, a child crying, all this stuff going on. Eventually, Reverend Mark says to him, well, you let it out. I guess you're the one that's going to have to put it back. And he's like, what are you talking about? I have no clue what you're talking about. And he said, well, I'll be here tonight. I'll bring a shovel and the salt, and you're going to put it, get rid of this thing once and for all. This young guy is so far over his head. He's beyond confused. He's not sure what to say. He doesn't even want to tell his family what's going on, because how do you make sense out of this to normal people? You know? But that afternoon he does go talk to his dad, and he tells his dad pretty much everything that's going on. And his dad's like, this is crazy. It can't be happening. You're imagining it. They're tricking you somehow. I don't know what the end game of this is, but this has to be somebody putting it on. And he kind of goes back to the apartment thinking, yeah, my dad's right. I'm just overreacting because I'm scared and in a bad situation. I just need to calm down and tell them not to show up. And that lasts for all of about an hour or two, until he's sitting in the living room and the TV picks itself up on the stand. Now, for those who don't know, there used to be these old TV stands. They were god-awful looking things. And you had a portable TV. It was sitting on a stand. Usually you had it attached to rabbit ears that stuck up in the back, or antennas. And you were lucky if you could get two channels or three as a general rule. And you moved these little antennas in order to find the new channel if you were lucky. So he's sitting there trying to watch the local channel, and the TV, stand and all, lifts up about 8 inches off the floor. The TV tips forward and crashes onto the floor and bursts, as you can imagine. Fire and light and what have you come flying out of the TV for a few seconds, and he unplugs it and he's really shocked. At that point, something hits him in the back of the head, and he's by himself in the room. Nellie is pregnant, and she and the toddler are out somewhere. And it hits him so hard, it knocks him to his knees. And then he hears a male voice, the first time he hears a male voice. And the male voice says, you can't get rid of me. Okay, at this point, he's out the door, and he is completely convinced that whatever this Reverend Mark's going to tell him to do, he's going to do. Because whatever it is that's going to get rid of this thing, that's the ticket, man. So that night, the Reverend shows up, and he has a shovel, and he has this little, salt can. Remember the old Morton salt cans that we used to have with the little flip top and everything? So he has one of those, and he has one of those bundles of newspaper all twisted up. And he says to him, going to the northwest corner of the apartment building. Now it's like 9-10 o'clock at night. Everybody's kind of settled in. It's quiet. And he's like, what are we going to do? And he's like, you're going to dig a hole. We're going to put salt in the hole. I'm going to say a prayer. You're going to put what's in this newspaper in the hole. And then you're going to put salt on top of it. And then you're going to cover it up. And that will take care of it. He's like, what's in the newspaper? He's like, you don't need to know. Just follow the directions. So this young guy goes out with him. The Reverend Mark's holding a flashlight in one hand so he can see to dig. He digs a hole under the northwest corner of the house. Just a small one. I mean, he wasn't like he was digging for an hour. 5 or 6 shovelfuls of dirt out from underneath that edge. And Reverend stops him and says, that's enough. So he does the salt in the hole. The Reverend says some sort of a prayer, incantation, something. He's mumbling. He can't quite make out the words. It's the hairs on the back of his neck go up. And you know how you get that shiver down your spine kind of a thing? Like your hackles go up and then you get that shiver. But he can't tell quite what the words are. And the Reverend looks at him and he says, okay, unwrap the newspaper and dump it in. For all the world, when he unwraps this newspaper, it looks like the arm and shoulder of a withered up baby doll. And he drops it in there and he says, what the hell is that? And he said, I told you don't ask. And he said, what the hell is that? And he said, well, you must know it's part of a baby. He's like a baby, like a real baby? He's like, yeah, like a real baby. You see, back in the 1950s and 60s, they buried their dead, but they didn't have to have vaults. He would go out to the cemetery and dig up and take body parts for whatever weird stuff he was doing. This young guy would later hear stories about them going out to cemeteries and talking to the dead by putting stethoscopes on tombstones. And like, they were just really, really crazy people. And he's kind of stuck in the middle of this. Now he doesn't know what to do. Technically, I guess it is a crime, but it wasn't a murder victim or anything like that. And what do you do with this? So he finishes what he was told to do, put salt on top of it. More prayers are said, cover it up. And the Reverend had actually thought of everything. So he brought a little potted plant. He said, this will cover up the fact you've been digging. Just sit this here, because it was not too far from their front door. So he did, went back in. And the Reverend told him, he said, don't ever go in that shed again. I keep them demons in that shed. He's like, what do you mean you keep demons in the shed? You're crazy. He's like, there's a lot of stuff you don't know. You can hold on to demons. You can control them if you know how. And I keep them in the shed. Don't mess with them again. And he leaves. Well, whatever happened that night, it took care of whatever it was. There was no more activity. And the young man would stay with this woman for several years. Eventually, the crazy just got too much for him, and he did leave. But he was completely convinced that whatever they were doing was demonic in nature, and he had accidentally, when his curiosity got the best of him, and he thinks even that might have been because the demon one had left out, so it was drawing him in with it, you know, by making him curious, then he left something loose. It's the craziest story. I know it sounds nuts, but when you hear that young guy tell it, I mean, he's an old man now, but when you would hear him tell it, the fear and the sincerity in his voice were terrifying, just terrifying. He never changed his story, never wavered. You know, it just was the most insane story I've ever heard.
I concur. That's probably the most bizarre thing that I've heard, if not in a long time, ever.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, I've not really written about it. It will go in the Demons in Penn's Woods book because it fits. And it's, you know, basically, I think it's time maybe to tell the story, because who knows. The old farm up there still exists. Reverend Mark, all the players are dead now except one. And people own the house. They tore the property. They tore the house down. I don't know whatever happened to the shed. I'm not sure if it's still back in the woods or not. You would have to trespass to find out. But I do know they tore the house down. They did not put another house on that piece of ground there. They moved the house a mile and a half away on this old farm. I don't know if it's because something was happening or if it was because they just wanted a different location. I can't tell you that, but I can only tell you that something happened, something significant enough that it changed this guy's life.
In your dealings, have you had or heard any stories like that where actual human body parts were used as part of a cleansing ritual?
In Haiti and South Africa, yeah. It's not, I mean, we use mostly Christian rituals in the United States, Catholic rituals, you know, that kind of stuff, prayers. There are Buddhist rituals. There are other, you know, faith rituals, based rituals. I've heard a couple stories, can't vouch for them, about satanic groups that have tried to, you know, mess with demonic entities and control them and used body parts. But the vast majority of those stories would come out of like Haiti and South Africa, and you know, it's part of a more ancient earth religions, if you will. So that's my weird story.
All right, I'm kind of pining back for the old ghost stories again.
Already? We just started. So I want to talk about another demonic story, if you will. Now, it's fascinating to me, you know, how a few years ago, A Haunting and all these different TV shows came out, and they all were looking for people that had interesting, unusual paranormal experiences. So from all of that, there have been a plethora of these types of stories, of demonic stories and things like that. And there was one in a little place called Montaudon here in Pennsylvania. And it's down on the Susquehanna River. And it's a very tiny area. So the family's name was Rurik. I'm not giving away a secret. They announced it on the TV show. It was three people, Jacinda and Todd, the parents, and their about 13, 14-year-old son, Justin. They had lived in the house for quite a while, several years. Nothing had happened. And in 2013, Jacinda had to have surgery, a significant surgery. And after the surgery, she couldn't really get out and do anything much. So she decided to, you know, look at photo albums, get things rearranged, jobs that require very little physical labor, you know. So she's looking at the photo albums and kind of like rearranging things, getting like all the family pictures from each year in order, and the, you know, family picnics and all of this. And she starts to notice that all the pictures in the house have a lot of orbs in them. And, you know, first you see a couple and you don't think much of it. But as you're looking through them, picture after picture after picture, they're in almost everyone inside the house or at the property. Now, when she took pictures at other family members' homes, and when she took pictures at picnic grounds and stuff like that outside of her property, there weren't a lot of orbs. So she just thought that was an oddity, and she kind of just marked it down to, isn't that interesting? And then she showed her husband one night, and she said, I wonder if it's my mom or dad's mom and dad. Maybe they're coming to visit. It's a nice comforting thought. Grandpa and grandma hang out at the holidays, kind of a deal, you know? Nothing major. That's not what ends up happening. So this is a nice little family, very tight-knit, close to their relatives, and they're just kind of moseying on through their life when, after the photographs, they begin to hear a voice in the house. First, she hears it. Well, she's stuck in the house right now full time, and things start getting moved around. You know, she's all by herself, and she sits down the sugar bowl on the table and goes and pours the cup of coffee, and then comes back to add another teaspoon of sugar, and it's not there. And she finds it in the freezer, or, you know, in the bathroom, sitting on the commode, or some bizarre place that you know you wouldn't have put it. And it's puzzling. She starts talking about it to her husband, and he's like, stop it. You're going to have our son freaking out. And it isn't long until her son comes to her and says, Mom, I've heard kids running up and down the hallway. I don't know how to explain it. It just sounds like kids, you know, that da 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 da, and giggling. And he's like, I never heard it before, but I hear it a good bit. And they laugh, and they shut the closet door on me. And they move the curtains, and I hear them giggle when they do it. It's really creepy. Well, she starts talking to her husband, and he's like, see, I told you, going to screw things up, and now he's all imagining things. She's like, but I didn't tell him. I only told you. So the dad is marking it down as too much time on your hands, imagination, and then the power of suggestion. Until one night they're all sitting at dinner, and they're eating, and all of a sudden he starts to gag. And he's clawing at his throat. And of course, the first thought is that he's choking to death.
Right.
And she jumps up and she's panicking. And he's trying to rip at something. And eventually, when all the panic subsides and everything, he says something attacked him and was squeezing his throat like this. and he was trying to pry that whatever it was, his fingers or, you know, the pressure off of his neck. So at this point, they don't have an answer. So eventually they see this TV show and stuff's just going on over and over again. You know, things moving, the family animals don't want to be in certain areas, sounds that you can't explain, things like that. So they call this show because one of the things that the shows were promising is we'll get somebody in to help you if we pick their case. And they ended up picking this case. I found an interesting article about it that was written from the perspective of the producer of the show. And they were asking her questions about how do you decide which cases to pick and which not to. And she said, by the amount of fear in their voices, if I really believe they're telling me the truth and they're frightened, I'll pick their case so maybe we can help them. So they ended up picking this couple's case, and they contacted a local man in that region. His name's Kevin Trusavage, who, by the way, I happen to know. I've known Kevin for 25 or 30 years. And he's a real funny man, but very serious about his craft. He's taught paranormal investigating and demonology, and he's trained under at least two different demonologists. I think it was an Anglican and the Byzantine churches. And I mean, he put in like 5-6 years each place. So he learned his craft, and he's really good at what he does. And he goes into the case, brings along with him a young lady who's a psychic. He has her walk the house, tell him what's going on. The first thing she says is, I see a kid, a little boy, and he's running at me. And he seems just to be a child. Well, I have to tell you, one of the things as an investigator that we look for are the idea that the demon is manifesting as a innocent party, because demons don't start out usually as nasty. And a lot of times when an investigator will come in, they'll become even more pathetic. So there's a case I did in West Virginia where the entity portrayed itself as a young lady with Down syndrome, a teenage girl with Down syndrome. And that's really important because it was manifesting to one of the young women who lived in this apartment building whose sister was a teenage girl with Down syndrome. So she had a great deal of sympathy for that particular aspect. And when she saw the girl with Down syndrome, she's like, oh, you're like my sister. I know they're afraid of you, but don't be afraid. You can stay here with me in my room.
Uh-oh.
So it was, you know, that's how they get you to cave in, and that's what started what ended up being a demonic case for us. And so she tells Kevin what she's seeing. She's like, but there's something wrong. I know this isn't a kid. And he's like, not a surprise. So he begins to work the case. And right after he starts working the case, the family has a really odd experience. They're in the home, they're talking to him, and all of a sudden, Jacinda, the wife, looks up and she has this panicked, horrified look on her face. And he looks up and they all see it, all three of them. This is what they described it as. It was a shadow figure with the ability to control the number of tentacle-like appendages that protrude from its body. So it's this dark, shadowy thing moving, undulating its tentacles. And I have heard those stories before. I've seen three different cases where I've seen that type of an entity. Okay. And they do try to recreate that for the TV series. And they actually asked the young producer about this. And she says, you know, sometimes we do take artistic liberty, but we didn't have to in this case. If that isn't scary enough, I don't know what you need.
That's right out of, you know, Lovecraft and Cthulhu. Yeah.
So Kevin starts working the case, and eventually this thing actually begins to attack the boy systematically. In fact, it overpowers him and possesses him to the point where his eyes become all black whenever it's moving through him and manifesting. And he ends up needing an exorcism privately. The house becomes quiet and calm. as long as the boy's not in it. So through a series of exorcisms that last quite a while, several months, this case is finally solved. And some of the weird things about this case is that, and I can't even imagine how this is possible. So anybody who ever had to take like daily medications, if you could imagine somebody opening your pill bottles and standing all of your pills up on end and stacking them on top of each other, 3, 4, 5 stories high, and nothing falling over, they would find stuff like that. Like she would get up and see the pills and they're sitting on the table on the ends and they're stacked up like little pyramids. It was just a really strange case. Eventually, Kevin does get rid of what's going on. He does help the family and it does work out, but it takes quite a while. And to this day, they're not sure what started it. They only know that it was after she began to notice all these orbs in the pictures that something seemed to take notice and manifest itself. I can't explain. Nobody can explain. Kevin doesn't know why. The best of my knowledge, anyway.
That just sounds like there's a missing piece of the puzzle that either somebody didn't divulge or didn't correlate as part of the activity.
And some, maybe somebody, maybe she said something, maybe something happened, maybe something just saw that she was injured and she was weak and she was interested and just decided to come and take that opportunity, because that can happen. I mean, people think all the time that you have to do something, and you do, but it can be really, really innocent. Like they skirt right along the edge of the line. If you have to invite something into your life, it can be just as simple as, I'm curious, I wonder what that is. Wonder if it's a ghost. Well, hey, you're interested in the paranormal, let me show you what the paranormal looks like. And it's just an odd, odd case. So I want to go to one that was at least nationally known at one time, and it was the case of the Smurls in West Pittston, PA. So for those who don't know, in the mid-1970s, there was a hurricane that came through the area, destroyed a lot of properties, and among the people who were displaced was the Smurl family. They had lived in a huge old house. It was Mr. and Mrs. Smurl, Mr. Smurl's mother and father, and their teenage and younger children. So I think they had 3 or 4 children. I think they were all girls. After this was all said and done, the insurance came through, but it wasn't a huge amount of money. People didn't have house insurance like they do today back in the 70s. You know, they just didn't. So it wasn't a huge amount of money, and they had to find a new place to live. So they decided to pool the money together and try to buy a place. So they found this old house. It was in pretty decent shape. It was a double house, so there was a large half and then a small half, what we might call an in-laws apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was perfect. You know, mom and dad could have their own space. They could still be close enough that they could get help from the Smurls, the kids. And it was big enough for the other section for all the kids and them. So seemed like a good fit, and it wasn't super expensive. So they went for it. Now, this is a nice Catholic family. They had no history of paranormal activity. They had no interest in the paranormal at all. I mean, these were the devout people that went to church every time the doors were open, focused on sporting events with their kids and school events and volunteering at the church, clubs and what have you. They weren't interested in the paranormal in any way, size, shape, or form. Right after they move into the house, activity begins. And at first, it's as usual, it's pretty much just ghost stuff. Like the younger Mrs. Smurl, Janet, was in the living room one day and she's folding laundry and she hears her mother-in-law yell, "Janet, don't talk to me like that. What are you talking about?" So she yells out, "Mom, are you okay?" Because they had a common wall there in the living room. And
obviously thin.
Yeah, well, yeah. A lot of these old houses had thin walls. So anyway, she's like, Mom, are you okay? And she's like, Janet, don't talk to me like that. So she puts down the laundry she's folding and goes around on the porch and knocks on the door. And she's like, Mom, are you all right? And she's like, well, can't even understand why you would speak to me that way, Janet. And she's like, what are you talking about? She's like, I heard you say all those terrible, mean things about me. And Janet's completely confused. She heard nothing. And then her mother-in-law proceeds to say, you know, she was called a bitch and I hate you and I wish you would just die and all these terrible things in Janet's voice. And it sounded like it was coming out of their living room, Janet and her husband's living room. So her mother-in-law, you know, she's like, well, Mom, I never said this. I swear. And she's almost in tears. And because she can see her mother-in-law is really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really smooth over. They just kind of drop the subject. And she tells her husband that night about it. And he's like, oh, you know, maybe she was listening to the TV and forgot she had it on. Or, you know, he came up with whatever lame excuse he could dig up at that moment. But things kept going. She would hear her mother-in-law over there yelling at her. And she would go over and she'd say, Mom, it's not me. And then one day she's standing there talking to her mother-in-law. And from behind her mother-in-law, she hears her own voice say, get the hell out of here, bitch. And they look at each other. And that's when they realize. Up till then, I think the mother-in-law really believed that there was some latent hostility getting vented here. And now they can't explain it at all. Then the traditional stuff happens, you know, cabinet doors opening and closing, stuff like that. But it very quickly escalates. The TV bursts into flames while they're watching it one night. The toilets begin flushing by themselves. Water turns itself on and off. The swing hanging lights in the kitchen begin to swing on their own, will reverse and swing other ways. And one day they're getting ready for Sunday school and she's doing one of the kids' hair standing in the kitchen right by the table and the light's right above them. And she's actually chose that spot because the light's right above them so that she can see better. And the light begins to swing and drops. And if she at the last moment hadn't caught the motion of it coming down and pulled their daughter away, their daughter would have been hit by this huge glass chandelier light and probably at least injured and possibly died. So other things began to stop working, equipment, or it would turn itself on. You'd unplug the blender and go to walk out of the kitchen and it would turn itself on, but it's still unplugged. Stuff like that. And then claw marks began to appear in the bathroom, as though something large, not a cat, something that had to be the size of a large dog, was sharpening or tearing at the walls with its claws. They can't explain it. There's nothing you can come up with for this. They don't see any animals. They just see the results. And they actually see them happening in front of them sometimes. Like you go into the bathroom to go to the bathroom and suddenly the wall starts flaking off as though something's digging its claws into the wall. Well, eventually it comes to the point where there is a full-bodied apparition that appears above the beds of the kids and scares them. The worst of it happens on two different occasions in the master bedroom. On one night, Janet's asleep. Jack is laying there. Jack wakes up and rolls over and comes face to face with what looks like an old hag. It's his wife's body. But her face has changed. Her hair is gray and ratted, and her face has scratches all over it. And he jumps out of bed, and she kind of grins at him knowingly. And at that point, he slams into the wall, makes a huge thud, flips the light on. And when Janet kind of falls back down onto the bed, and at that point, when she stands back up again, she's herself. And he's horrified by what he saw. And she's like, are you sure it's not a nightmare? It all culminates one night. He's watching TV and it's 10, 11 o'clock at night, waiting for the news to come on. And all of a sudden something pulls him out of the easy chair in the living room by the front of his shirt, flops him down onto the floor onto his back, and literally he can feel the weight. He doesn't see it at first, but he can feel the weight of a body on him. Whatever it is leaning over him, pinning his shoulders to the ground so he can't move. It's really strong, and it's a straddle his waist. And as he's laying there trying to fight this thing, it materializes into that old hag and attempts to sexually attack him. At that same time, he smells these terrible rotting odors. Eventually, this will come to the point where she goes to the priest and she tries to ask the priest for help. And the priest is like, no, we don't do that stuff. He gives her a bottle of holy water and says, if something happens, splash holy water at it and good luck. And yeah, that happens more often than I could even begin to tell you, because either they don't believe it's true, or if it is true, they're afraid of it. And I used to get really angry about that, but I've gotten older and I do now understand their fear. Like, you know, you sign up to be a minister or a priest and you think you're going to help people and you're going to be, you know, like a representative of God on earth, doing good things and preaching and talking nicely. And you do not expect that you're going to be facing satanic hags that try to sexually molest people. It's just not in the job description as a normal job description, you know? And so that it's out of your, it's really out of your bailiwick. And so sometimes they just can't. This goes on for several months and she continues to plead for help from the priest. Eventually, a church group from another church hears about what's going on. It ends up becoming the talk of the town. And they start showing up at night and standing on the porch and praying and singing to try to bring some relief. This will all culminate whenever she hears about one of the local colleges has this couple who are supposed to be demonologists coming in to speak. And of course, it's Ed and Lorraine Warren.
You didn't even have to tell me that, but
yeah. Yeah. So after the event, she talks to them and explains everything. And much to her relief, they don't blow her off. They're like, I'll tell you what, we're going to be here for a day or two yet. Why don't we come in the morning and visit you and see what's going on? Eventually, they will make arrangements with the local priest. And with the sanctioning of the Catholic Church, he will participate with them in doing an exorcism. This becomes a 7 days wonder. There are other TV companies from all over the world that show up in their front yard. She can't go out to go to the grocery store without being accosted by 30 reporters. The world just becomes extremely difficult. It's bad enough to live through this, but then when you ask for help, somebody leaks it out to the press, and now you're a freak show. Eventually, the Warrens and the priests do perform several exorcisms within the house. The activity slows down, but now everybody knows about the house on West Pittston, you know, and people keep coming and showing up, crazies that want you to touch them so that they can, you know, experience the demonic for themselves. And just, I mean, it becomes a freak show. There's no other way to explain it. And reporters and skeptics and local kids egg your house and, oh, there's the ghost people. It's just horrible. So eventually they decide to rent a house elsewhere, put their house on the market, and leave. The Smurls will say that there is a little tiny bit of residual activity that happened once they moved, which was a very frightening thing, as you can well imagine, at the beginning. But as they ignored it and they called for their priest and their priest came and addressed it right away, it didn't last for any length of time. But again, it is just a horrendous event. And this lasted for them 2 years, almost three. And it is still one of the most well-documented and well-known events of demonic activity in Pennsylvania.
And no reason for it at all.
There's nothing that anybody has ever, I mean, I can't tell you that they did anything wrong. I don't know. Nobody knows why it started. They were just in a bad place emotionally because of everything that had happened, losing their home, having to be displaced, struggling. I don't know if that was just enough weakness for this thing to decide to take them on, try their faith, and it tried their faith. If you can imagine begging, literally begging with tears running down your face for help and nobody in your church listening, and you don't know where else to go, who do you call for this stuff? You know, that's how I ended up getting involved in the first place, because I got to that point with a couple cases where who do you call? And you can't put this off on somebody else at some level. And I knew people that were demonologists and exorcists because of my work in the field. And I called one of them and he said to me, "You have everything right. This is a demonic case." And I'm like, "Great, Keith, can you come down and help me?" And he's like, "I can't. I'm in Rhode Island. They don't have the money to get me down there and, you know, help me to." And he's not a rich man. Mm-hmm. He works a day job like everybody else. So the travel expenses and what have you to do this over and over again would have just been prohibitive. And I said, "Well, then what do I do?" And he's like, "Okay, so you're going to be on the phone with me every night and we're going to walk through this together, and you're my legs and you're my eyes." And that's how I did my first case.
Literally trial by fire.
Literally. And I just had faith in God and had faith in Keith. And I would call him up and this is what's going on. And whenever I couldn't get him, I called John Zaffis, who's a dear friend and also knows Keith very well. They've worked together, and I would get help from whichever one was home at that moment. And what am I supposed to do now? Go with your gut, Patty. What do you think? And then I would say, and they would talk me through it. And this is how it's going to have to look. And this is what you've got to say. I'll send you this information. And then I would go back over to that house and we'd do it again. Interesting case. In fact, I will tell that one as my last case. So this was my very first case of a demonic entity. It didn't start out to be a demonic entity. This was right as the TV shows began to come out. And anybody who was in the paranormal field at that time, there was this really bizarre phenomena. Up to that point, people were very private about their paranormal experiences. You didn't tell everybody. A lot of times they would live with it in silence for years. So right as this TV show start coming out, Ghost Hunters and all these different shows, there was the opposite effect. People started coming out of the woodwork saying, "My house is possessed, my daughter's possessed, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think my son is psychic." And then the next question would kind of tip you off. "Do you think I could get on a TV show?" You know? So right as these shows started, there was one of those show companies that got called for a case. And the person who was working the phones for that particular paranormal group knew when they heard this stuff that this was a real case. So before the show blew up and went crazy and they left, because now all of a sudden it became a property for a production company, and they had their own people there. And like, the handwriting was on the wall at that point. And there were five cases that they didn't turn over to the production company. And they were five cases they thought were legit. This was one of them. And it was handed to me by that person. "Go check this out. She's got some serious issues going on." And they don't want any publicity. So I called the family. Basically, it was this man and his wife. And she had a young lady who she was trying to help, who had been homeless, who has now become a family friend and is living in their spare bedroom. The man is a prison guard at a state facility. Very no nonsense. She was a nurse. Very no nonsense. And the young lady was just kind of getting back up on her feet. But she seemed nice. And she's the one who called, not the couple, because she was concerned for the young woman, the nurse. And so I go out. I brought with me three team members. It's a long drive, 2 hours, 2.5 hour drive to this place. I go out there. We had made arrangements with everybody. I had cleared everything. did my preliminary talk with the husband, did the preliminary talk with the best friend, and was coming out to meet the wife that day and hopefully work what I thought was going to be a haunting, a serious haunting. And I get there, and it's in the middle of the woods, and the doors are hanging open, and the windows are up in the house, and the dog is in the house barking, but nobody answers the door, and there's no cars in the driveway. And it looks for all the world like somebody ran out at the last minute and didn't even shut the screen door. So it's just flapping in the wind, you know? So we try to call into the house, and I'm like, well, maybe somebody ran to the store for something, and there's somebody in the house waiting for us. So we called in. We could hear the telephone ring. We could hear the dog barking. And then all of a sudden, the phone came off the hook. We could hear it being lifted up. And then it was dropped, and the dog went insane. So my best guess was the dog was loose and jumped up and hit the phone and knocked it off the hook. My best guess. Obviously, nobody was there. We waited about an hour, hour and a half, and nobody came home, so we left. We no sooner get back to our home area when the phone rings, and it's the best friend, and she's crying, and she's like, we're so sorry, we missed you. She's in the hospital. She had this attack. She couldn't breathe. She had turned purple. We called the paramedics. We all went to the hospital. We're so sorry. And that's what started this case. And basically, I know that this particular case began when she was a kid. She and her father and mother had moved to the family farm. Her grandfather had always told them that there was this area off this one cornfield. And it always annoyed her dad because the cornfield was kind of like a triangle, but there was plenty of room to straighten out the cornfield. But the old man wouldn't do it because he kept saying that it was a graveyard and you shouldn't mess with it. And there weren't any tombstones or anything, but he said it was an old graveyard. He knew it was an old graveyard. So when the old man dies, they decide to put a house up so they can be close to grandma because she needs some assistance. And now her husband's gone and he's not there to help. And so dad decides it's a nice flat area. It's really going to, it has already has some road cut up to that corner where the of that triangle. He's going to straighten that field out, shorten it, and take that piece of ground and turn it into their yard and their house. So he sets it up to do this because it's literally within walking distance of mom and dad's house. And when they do, it's a rural area. He has a friend bring a digger to come in and dig for the foundation. And after they stop after it starts like this really hard downpour, they're about 2/3 of the way done. And the rain just, it's torrents of rain, which, you know, in Pennsylvania, we get rains like that sometimes. And they begin to see what look like bones in the debris that's been dug up. And at that point, she's about 10 years old. She's freaked out. Her dad tells her to go back to the house. Don't say anything to your mom. It'll scare her. It's ridiculous. It's deer bones. That's all it is, just deer bones. And then the bones disappear. Like, he gathers them up, gets rid of them somehow, whatever. But they're gone. They put the house in. He puts the foundation in himself. They put the house in. Nice house. They move in. It's one of those modulars, you know, so it's like one of those prefabs. You set it down real fast, it's done, boom. And that's when the activity actually started, and they had a really severe haunting, including what she calls the rotted meat man, which was this man who appeared with this maggoty face, and he smelled like rotted meat. And everybody thought she was crazy until other people began to see it, and eventually they ended up that her mom and her brother left the property. Her dad ended up moving in with his mother, and it broke up the marriage, and their lives were just different. But it stopped then until she had had surgery and had died on the table. And when she came back, the first thing she saw was the maggoty meat man. And from that point forward, activity began at their home. Until then, there had not been any. It started out at the house, not like it wasn't the maggoty meat man that they saw at the house. They saw a figure that looked like her, and talked and sounded like her. And for example, the husband was in the basement. He had weights, you know, gym equipment. And he's down there and he sees his wife walk through the basement and he yells, "Hey, what are you getting out of the freezer? We're getting ready to make lunch," because she's headed for the freezer. And she doesn't say anything. And he yells, "Hey, what are you planning for lunch?" And again, she doesn't say anything, but she stops. So he lays down the weights that he's been lifting, kind of gets up and he's like, "Hey, are you mad at me or something?" And he walks toward her, she turns around, and then is just gone. And he realizes that she hasn't come back from the store, that the car's still missing, and she and her friend are not home. And this continues on. It gets much worse. She would wake up in the middle of the night, and this maggoty meat man would be trying to touch her. She would put pillows all around the bed so that he couldn't touch her. He invaded her dreams. It was driving her literally insane. And I don't know how else to explain it. At one point, I realized that she was oppressed at the very least, possibly possessed. She would talk about herself in the third person. She would say to him, she would be talking to me in the first person, and all of a sudden she turned to her husband and she'd say, "You see, she told you to do this," whatever it would be, like go to the store or get milk or whatever, "but you never listen to her, do you? That's why I have to be here, because you don't listen to her. You never listen to her." And at that moment, their dog, which was laying at her feet, would jump up, his hackles would rise, and he would like backpedal away from her and growl. And then she would be herself again. And she would turn to me and she'd say, "So what was I saying?" And then the dog would come back over and lay down. At one point on video, I had her physically changing her body shape. So she was a young woman, very fit, not overweight at all. And I asked the doctor, who's a friend of mine, MD, to come with me because I wanted somebody else to see what I was seeing. That was a medical observer. She agreed. So I have video cameras set up all over. Every time I went to this place, I had video cameras set up all over. And the young lady's all hunched up on her chair at the kitchen table in the dining area. It's like a big open plan. So it's living room, dining room, and kitchen. And it's just all one huge room. And I have the cameras up. And as we're talking, she suddenly leans forward and she grows a goiter. I mean, literally grows a goiter. You can see it grow on camera. And she hunches up and her back kind of poofs up a little bit as though she's heavier set. And her arms kind of, the clothing poofs up a little bit as though she's putting on weight. And she looks at me and she says, "So what do you think you're going to do now? Huh? You think you can deal with this?" And the dog gets up and backs up and she turns and she looks at the dog. And I swear to you, in the camera, her eyes, they look like an animal's eyes. They have that reflective quality, right? And she goes, "What's your problem?" to the dog. And the dog just literally runs out of the room as fast as it can get. And she looks back at me and she said, "And like I said, what are you going to do about me now? Huh? You think you can deal with this?" And then in 3 seconds, it's all gone. And she starts to cry and she says, "Whatever I say, don't believe me. Just help me. Please help me. Promise me you won't leave just because I say mean things. Help me, please." All of it's on camera. The doc told me later, she's like, "That is the freakiest thing I've ever seen in my entire life." So we ended up doing the exorcism of this house and her, working this case. I had things happen, like we had a manifestation. Two of my investigators are on the first floor. They're going up to the second floor. And in front of them, they see pant legs, blue pant legs going. My friend, the first one, is a female. She's going up and then behind her is somebody else. She doesn't know who's behind her because she's worried about getting up there and getting the camera set up. And she just assumed there's three of them on the steps. She assumes the first one is a friend of ours, Charlie, who's on the case with us. And she hadn't really been paying attention to his clothing. So she just, you know, he has blue pants on today. She goes up the stairs and it opens into this wide landing area. And Charlie says to her from behind her, "Where do you think we should set the cameras up?" She whirls around and she's like, "I thought you were in front of me." He's like, "There wasn't anybody in front of you." She's like, "Yes, there was. There was a guy wearing blue pants. I saw him." The weirdest thing, one of my guys was in the spare bedroom where the friend was living, and she's working, running EMFs and stuff like this. Unbeknownst to all of us, it's middle of winter, she has on a heavy shirt and then a big turtleneck over top of it, and they're tucked into her pants at the bottom, the waist. She had put on a cross, a wooden cross on a knotted rawhide, piece of rawhide, okay, over her neck, and it was down in, tucked into her bra, and you couldn't see anything of it. But she had put it on for her own personal protection. She felt it would make her safer. She looks at me and she says, "I can't find it." And I said, "What do you mean you can't find it?" She's like, "I can't find my cross." And I'm like, "What cross?" Because I'd been working with her off and on all day, and there's no cross. She's like, "I had a cross on me. It was down underneath." And I'm like, "Well, did it fall out?" And she's like, "No, my shirt's tucked in." But she pulled her shirt out, shook her shirts out, nothing. And she tucks them back in. And I said, "Well, maybe it fell on your bra." And she pulls her shirt off, you know, out like this, and looks, and there's nothing there. And I'm taking a flashlight and shining, like, in the corners of the room, looking all around. Maybe it fell off, it, like, untied itself. You know how sometimes rawhide will kind of just open because it's the material it is. And she's like, "Yeah, but if it did, wouldn't it have just fallen in my shirt?" And at that moment, right behind the door, which is where she was standing when she realized that it was gone, and she had kind of stepped out to call me into the room, and then back into the room she went. Nobody passed her. Nobody passed me because I was in the hallway. So if you would have gone into that room, I would have seen you because I was standing in that hallway maybe 5 feet from the doorway looking in down that hallway. So you'd have had to come back from the back behind me, pass me on that side, or from the end of the hallway up toward me. Either way, I would have seen you. I went in the room and I shut the door to look behind the door, and hanging on the hook on the back of the door is the cross, still knotted, and somebody had taken a marker and wrote, "Jesus loves me" underneath it on the door wall. Now, we had 5,000-6,000 photographs of that room, and their time and date stamped. There was nothing written on that wall 5 minutes earlier. Can't explain it. But here's the end of the story, and it may not be a satisfying end, but it is the end. So we're going through this process. We have finally got a local pastor from West Virginia who's willing to make the 4-hour drive to come and finish the exorcisms with me. We've got the house blessed. We've got the grounds blessed. We're working on taking care of the thing with her. I come up to the property because they wouldn't answer the phone. And that was a feature of this investigation from the very beginning. I had a lot of difficulty with phone calls to this family. And this was in the day when we still used the rotary phones. So I would call the operator eventually and they would be like, "Well, there's nothing wrong with the lines down there. We should be able to get this call through." And sometimes they couldn't even get the calls to go through. And so anyhow, because I'd had trouble with it, it had been like a week and a half of not being able to get her on the phone. I decided on a Saturday morning to drive down by myself just to talk to her and make sure that everybody was okay and tell her we had everything set up and I just needed to get a date for them. And I get down there and there's a for sale sign on the bottom of the yard and there's no curtains on the windows. I drive up and the house is completely empty. It's a beautiful house, completely empty. And I'm like, that's crazy. Like in a week and a half, they're just gone. So I call the phone number for them. I call her husband's cell number because he had a cell phone for work. Nothing, not a single thing. So I think, okay, after a couple of days of this, I'm getting really worried. So I finally decide I'm going to call his job. I'm just going to say that there's an emergency and I was wondering if I could just leave a message. could you get a hold of me at this number? This is an emergency. And they say, he doesn't work here anymore. And I'm like, what do you mean he doesn't work here? Dude, people don't quit jobs working for the state corrections facility. That's mega money. And he had been doing it for years. So it isn't like it was something he just didn't like, was over his head, something like that, right? And I'm like, he just stopped showing up for work about 2 weeks ago. He's been discharged. So I call the number on the for sale sign. Lady says, I can't give you information. All I can tell you is the house was put up for sale a little over 2 weeks ago. I'm like, can you get a message to them? She's like, I don't even talk to them. Everything's being run through his grandmother. I'm like, great. Can you get a message to grandma? And she's like, I can give your phone number to grandma. That's all I can do. So she did. And grandma called me and said, I don't know who you are or why you're asking. I don't know where my grandson is and his wife. All I know is he called me in the middle of the night one night and said that they had to leave and that he wanted to put the house up for sale and would I do this for him, manage this whole thing. And that's what I'm doing. And I said, well, how do you get a hold of him? And she said, I don't. He calls me. And that's where it ends.
Yeah, you're right. More questions than answers.
Yeah, completely.
Something would have to be extraordinarily drastic.
Yeah.
For somebody to do that. I mean, like Hollywood movie drastic, you know, like that kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am completely convinced before I die, I will finally get the answers to this case. I will bump into this one of them somewhere down my life. Hopefully she's okay. I think about her from time to time and him, and I pray that nothing bad happened. I know that it was escalating rapidly at that point. She was having blocks of time missing where she would not know where she was at, and he would find out that she would come home the next day and be shocked that a day and a half had gone by that he had been hunting her down. She had woke up sleeping in a car in the woods, and he was afraid to let her drive anymore because of this. And she kept saying that this thing was escalating in the house as well. And one last caveat, my oldest son, who's a bit of a, he's got a bit of bravado, if you will, was about 19 at the time. And I had told them I'm doing this case. And one of the pieces of advice I was given by my friends in the demonic community were, make sure your house is in order. Your kids know what's going on, how to protect themselves. And so I had a conversation with my son and he goes, cool. Well, if you chase it off, it can come visit me. At which point I scolded him rapidly and told him, don't say like that, you know, just don't. And about 7 days after we started the whole case, he came out to the dining room, sat down on the floor, put his head on my knee, and he said, I've had having this horrible, horrible nightmares. I see this man with a rotted face, and I'm sitting on the steps of a church. He walks up to me, and I know he's going to kill somebody. He's going to kill me, I think. But he turns around and he walks down to the edge of the church property and there's kids playing. And he picks up one of the children by their neck and he kills them. And I'm screaming, stop, stop, stop. And I wake up fighting to get to those kids before he kills the next one. It is the same nightmare she had been having nightly for over a month. So we ended up having to deal with that because he had invited it in. Stupid teenage bravado. So people can believe it. They cannot believe it. It's up to them. But that was my very first demonic case.
And wow. That's my only response is just, wow.
It was a mystery wrapped inside a puzzle. And I don't know. I mean, I've seen people. I work in the field of psychology. I have had clients or DIDs, which would be multiple personality people. And yes, their voice will change, their handwriting will change, but you can't grow a goiter. I can't explain the dog reacting differently to her. Like the dog loved her and it would just wag its tail and lay at her feet all the time until she would start doing this. And then the dog would run away until it was over and then come back. So with that, I am done.
Okay. This is going to be, I'm trying to think of a good title for this one. So you're going to have to tell me what's on the top of your notes.
Well, they actually are coming from a book called Demons in Penn's Woods. So you're more than free to use that because that's what they are. They're Demons in Penn's Woods.
All right, then. Well, I'm going to say good night, and I'm going to go pray for a while.
Sometimes after we're done, I do the same thing. I have to confess. But yeah, those are real cases. And I believe it or not, that's like four cases out of about 30 in the book.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to that book and reading it with all the lights on.
In the middle of the afternoon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. I have to tell you, once in my lifetime, I actually read a book that was so terrifying. I can't remember the name of the book, but I just remember sitting there reading the book. I was about 19. I read it and it was in the evening, and I ended up so paralyzed with fear, I could not move. And I was just sitting there. I quit reading it because I didn't want to go any further. It was that frightening. It was all true stories. This is when I was young. And my mom and sister showed up from church. It was a Sunday night. And I was so grateful because I literally was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I just sat there holding this book, not looking at it, waiting for somebody to come. It's the only time in my life I've ever been that frightened. And I don't know why. But so, the end.